This is the state of things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. As the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan continue, Army officials anticipate difficulty in convincing some 80,000 new soldiers to join up in the next fiscal year. So the Army has announced plans to add nearly 1,000 new recruiters in the coming months. And they've employed several other tactics to meet recruitment goals. In a program called Blue to Green, former Air Force and Navy personnel receive a $10,000 bonus for joining the Army. And there are plans to nearly double cash bonuses for new enlistees. The Army says it will meet its recruitment goal by the end of this fiscal year, which is soon, September 30th. But the National Guard expects to fall short of its goal. So who's joining up? What branch are they joining and why? Do recruitment issues today spell trouble ahead for the Army, the National Guard? Joining us on the line is UNC Chapel Hill military historian Dick Cohn. Thanks for being with us, Dick.
Pleasure to be with you.
And we welcome your calls this hour, 1-877-962-9862. Have you considered joining the military and why? So, Dick, the Army's increasing cash bonuses for enlistees, adding more recruitment officers, even seeking to persuade members of the other branches in the military to switch over to the Army. So how typical is that? Are those kind of lengths for the Army to go to boost recruitment?
Well, I think the only new one in there really is the Blue to Green program. Increasing bonuses, changing the conditions of service, perhaps the length of service, adding recruiters. Those are traditional methods by which you kind of lure young people into the service. So I think they're just turning to the tried and true.
But does even adding a new measure like the Blue to Green program indicate something that the military officers, the general staff should be concerned about?
Well, what it suggests is that they are worried and that they do want the most trainable and the best people they can get. And I think that's an innovative idea. But essentially what they're doing is doing everything in their power against a kind of a shrinking base, because after all, two-thirds of the youngsters now go to college, and you've got access to women, which you didn't have traditionally, or at least before the 70s in any large numbers. Clearly, they're worried, Rusty. I don't think there's any question about that. They've even dipped into their delayed entry group for next year, and I noticed that some of the bonuses expire September 27th. They're trying to pack the fiscal year so they can show they've made their targets.
And are there other measures that the military employs to deal with possible personnel shortages?
Well, obviously the one they've used so far, which has given us a lot of unease, is the stop-loss policy. One thing that's been going on kind of beneath the radar scope is that there have been tens of thousands of guardsmen and women and reservists on active duty more or less permanently in the last 3 or 4 years. And so they've made up some of their shortages by robbing the reserve components. Beyond just changing the kind of inducements, economic, educational, they can change the kind of ways in which you serve. Shorter enlistments might attract people, some kinds of benefits that might attract, say, college students for a short term. But a lot of it is dependent also on the economy. When the economy is strong or strengthening and there are lots of jobs, harder to recruit people.
And what about a war?
Well, a war usually provokes a surge of patriotism at the very beginning. I think one that drags on and that seems to have a less than believable strategic significance and not much showing that there's much end to it, like Iraq, does tend to depress recruiting somewhat.
Okay. And you mentioned stop-loss program. We have a call on the line that I'd love to take, but I just want you to define that for people.
Well, that's when the military says that they will cease permitting people to either retire or to leave the service when their enlistment contract is up. Almost every enlistment contract simply says in an emergency, or the service has the right to keep you in if they need you.
Dick Cohn, we have a call on the line. Andy's with us from Raleigh. Hi, Andy.
How are you?
Fine. What's on your mind today?
I just want to speak out in favor of, instead of the current administration's backdoor draft policy, which they seem to want to continue, I'm in favor of mandatory service, although not necessarily military service, for all young people that are qualified and, you know, not disabled.
Andy, did you serve in the military?
I sure did.
Yeah. Did you do it? Well, obviously, you must have done it voluntarily.
Back in the 60s, I served in Vietnam and in Germany.
And did you? So you volunteered back then, even though there was a draft.
That's right.
Right.
But I may have been close, so that's one of the reasons I volunteered.
Well, Dick Cone, what about this issue of a draft? I mean, if the military is has concerns about how to keep its personnel numbers at the levels they want, at the optimum levels, you know, is talk of a draft reasonable?
I don't think it is reasonable. Now, I sympathize with Andy's, you know, the ideological principle behind service. We have an obligation to serve as citizens, and we ought to be giving to our society. The problem with conscription is that it's almost impossible to do fairly. Even if you have a lottery and even if you only take a tiny few people, they are really burdened, and neither the politicians nor the American people want involuntary service, nor do the armed services. It's much more difficult to have people who don't want to serve there, and once they got used to the end of the draft, they liked it, particularly the idea that you can separate people from the service in training or afterwards if they're just not working out. And I think the problem is also cost. What are you going to do if you really do have a national service? What are you going to do with all these people? And how are you going to deal with the fairness of conscripting women but not putting them in combat? There are all sorts of complications, and the draft was really falling of its own weight in the 60s until Vietnam really made it indispensable.
Well, has there ever been an extended period of problems for the military meeting recruitment goals? I mean, maybe there just hasn't been a long enough period of problems reaching recruitment goals yet to warrant bringing back a draft.
Well, they had a real problem in the 1970s when we went to the all-volunteer force, and they had a great deal of difficulty meeting their targets. Eventually, they got enough, largely by the introduction of much larger proportions of women. And the other thing they can do is they can simply lower their standards, and that can be done. That is, take people who aren't high school graduates, take people who score less on the Armed Forces Qualification Test, and that's been used in the past, too.
Right, and that brings up, I mean, another measure I think the military uses is fast-tracking delayed entry program soldiers, right? These are people who are maybe not done with high school, they've enlisted, but they get to delay their entry into the
right.
into the military. But I think the military is interested in getting them into service faster, right?
They are. They're pushing that forward, and it's somewhat like, you know, giving bonuses or rebates in selling cars. You dip into your next year's sales by doing that, and it might not be over the medium term much of a gain.
Well, maybe the biggest recruitment problem is with the National Guard. The National Guard is expecting possible shortage this year, this fiscal year, as opposed to the Army, which is looking maybe a year down the road. Why do you think the National Guard's experiencing that kind
of problem? Well, I think you're absolutely right. The real crisis is going to come in the Guard because the Guard is being overused and overstretched. Beginning in the mid-90s, we began to use the Guard for what normally was regulars' duty, and people began to get called up more frequently, sent overseas, put in more dangerous situations, and called up for longer periods of time. And now with the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan and the shortage of certain specialties like military police and civil affairs people, some guards people are being sent overseas and then come home for a short period and are deployed, called up and deployed again. And I think they're simply wearing out the Guard. And the polling that's done amongst Guards people is showing that many of them are going to get out after they're permitted to get out here. And I think recruiting is going to be much more difficult.
We have another caller on the line, Dick. Her name is Kate from Cary. Her son graduated high school. And Kate, it sounds like your son has been preyed upon by military recruiters.
Yes, we were harassed. We were called multiple times or at least once a day. We kept asking them to stop calling us because my son was going to college, had already been accepted, and they wouldn't stop calling. They would keep asking him how he was going to pay for college and was he getting a scholarship and they could do better for him. And we continued to ask them to stop calling, and they wouldn't.
Well, Kate, stay on the line here for a second. And Dick, what about that? I mean, is that another symptom of a army stretched thin?
Well, I think it's a symptom of being much more aggressive. And yes, it is being stretched thin. But I must say that this is a traditional kind of thing about recruiters. Back in the 18th century, British Army recruiters did their recruiting in taverns and would get people inebriated, and they'd wake up in the military. Not always, not everywhere, but it occurred. Press gangs for the Navy. There has been, I think, an increasing aggressiveness,
and it is necessary. Well, telemarketers have to stop calling, don't they?
Pardon me?
Telemarketers have to stop calling if you ask them to stop. Doesn't the military?
I would think so, and in a situation like that, I would find out who these people's supervisors are, or call up the recruiting command a regional headquarters and file a complaint about an individual recruiter and name names and have specifics. And I think once that happens once or twice, the recruiters in that region will get the message.
Kate, I've just a half a minute here to ask you, where do you stand on the issue of drafting? I mean, you're the mother of a son who would be of draft age.
It terrifies me. It really terrifies me. I don't think it's a good idea because the people that end up being in the military then don't want to be there.
Right. Kate, thanks very much for your call. And Professor Dick Cohn, thanks so much for spending this time today with us talking about recruitment.
Thanks for having me, Rusty.
This is The State of Things. We're talking about, well, we've been talking about military recruitment. Coming up next in our next segment, post-deployment post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Otherwise, we're taking your calls 1-877-962-9862. Are you in the military, or do you know someone recently returned from combat duty? Are you worried about post-traumatic stress disorder? Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. A study published in the New England Journal of Medicine last month shows that troops returning from war in Iraq and Afghanistan are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder at almost the same rate as Vietnam War veterans. One Fort Bragg psychologist says crowds and stoplights can trigger stress reactions among recent war veterans, as can blue plastic Walmart bags, which resemble those used by insurgents to hide roadside bombs. Many think of post-traumatic stress disorder as the Vietnam disease. But if soldiers are still experiencing it today, is it simply an inevitability of war? Can anything be done to prevent it? Joining us in the studio is Dr. Harold Kudler. He's Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Duke University and Coordinator for Mental Health for the Veterans Administration Network No. 6. Thanks for being with us, Harold.
My pleasure.
And we'd also like to hear from you. 1-877-962-9862. Do you know a soldier with PTSD, that's post-traumatic stress disorder? What do you think should be done for those who suffer from that disorder? So, Harold, you called this New England Journal of Medicine study a landmark study, the one that was published in the journal. Why?
Well, it comes, first of all, from the Department of Defense. The researchers who did it were Walter Reed Research Institute members, and it's done for the first time in a large sample of combat veterans during the war itself. And we've never really had a study quite like this. And then it was published in the most important American Journal of Medicine. So it has wide distribution. And in many ways, it's a landmark study.
And what are the benefits of doing it during a war as opposed to, say, the first significant one, which came after Vietnam, right?
Right. And that one wasn't done until the late 1980s, which for the average person who was in that study was a big study, also involved almost 4,000 Vietnam veterans. But it was all done based on their recollections of what things were like 10 or 15 years ago. And here we have people talking about how they feel now in real time. And that makes it a very valuable study for us in the military and people like me in the VA, because we can begin to plan for the needs of these people, having much more accurate and recent information.
Now, researchers say the rate of PTSD among soldiers returning from Iraq is approaching the Vietnam War levels. But the war's not over, and symptoms don't necessarily show up right away. So do you expect a rate change, a rate increase, decrease?
It's a very good question. We know from Vietnam that a lot of the symptoms didn't show up right away, and it took months or years sometimes before people came forward. And we see the same pattern with people from World War II and the Korean War, which is really interesting because, you know, people often say, well, Vietnam was different and PTSD was a Vietnam problem. We never heard about this from World War II or Korean War veterans. But when you go back and ask World War II and Korean War veterans, many of them did have problems which their doctors didn't understand, didn't know how to label, didn't recognize. Now, with the lens of PTSD to go back and ask them, we see they also had these problems. So we're kind of coming to see PTSD as a human response to being in combat or other very stressful situations, and we believe that it's something that happens to people in all wars, and therefore we have to plan for it as part of planning for a war and the response to war.
Now, let's make sure all listeners know what we're talking about when we mention PTSD. So what, you know, describe what the symptoms are of this disorder.
Right. Well, first, to have PTSD, you have to live through something that's so stressful that you experience it with overwhelming horror or fear or helplessness. It really has to be something that sort of knocks the world out from under your feet. It can't just be a scary movie or a bad scare. It has to be something that's truly traumatic. And then once you've experienced something like that, you have PTSD if you have memories of it intruding into your mind. And this isn't like normal memory. These memories push in a way that's unwelcome, unlooked for, and even if you try to push them out, they won't go away. They tend to be like video replays for many people. So you could be having a dream, and instead of a normal dream where weird things kind of happen and maybe some scary things happen, it's like watching a videotape, or it's like really being there again. Or the same experience of really being there again might intrude in your waking life. So suddenly something happens, maybe a sound or a noise or a smell even. A lot of guys who are in the artillery, for instance, they use diesel engines to move artillery pieces. For a lot of guys, they'll pull up next to a diesel truck on the highway. There'll be that smell of diesel fuel, and suddenly it's like, I'm there again. And they may know the difference between really being there and not, or they may just lose it for a few minutes or even hours and not know where they've been, because for them, they've been back in the war. So intrusive memories, which could be flashbacks, nightmares, or just images that come into their mind while they're awake and conscious during the day. The next part has to do with avoidance. People tend to avoid anything that might remind them. I've known people who have not gone to the funerals of their parents, and that's not an uncommon thing among combat veterans because they can't stand funerals. They can't stand being around dead bodies or the grief that goes with it. They'll avoid airports if they were involved with airplanes, or if they were involved in the Navy, they may avoid ships, or anything that's a stark reminder they will go out of their way to avoid. And finally, this kind of mixed bag of what we call hyper-arousal, which basically means that they startle easily, they jump if somebody comes out behind them, they're always anxious, their hearts race, they can't sleep at night, even if they're not dreaming. It's not uncommon for them to say, I haven't had more than 3 hours of sleep in a night in the last 10 or 15 years. So these are the symptoms of PTSD. Some people may have some people may have all of them, and they can go on for years and years and wax and wane.
Right. And we should be clear that it's not just soldiers that experience post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, this can affect anybody, right? A civilian.
That's right. It could happen to people from training accidents in the military or civilian. It could happen from rape. It can happen from disaster. Certainly September 11th would be a good example. But we've seen this in floods and other kinds of disasters. So, yes, it's part of a human response. I kind of think of it as if we're born with a certain alarm that's supposed to go off in our head when the right danger is out there. We're supposed to have an alarm, and we're supposed to get into this special state of hyper-alertness and anxiety and watchfulness. The PTSD is when that alarm goes off, but it won't stop. So now you're no longer in an emergency situation. You've still got the alarm going, and it may go on for years.
I was going to take a call, but first I'd like to ask you, I mean, how likely is it if a soldier just back from war is experiencing some of these symptoms, how likely is it for that soldier to know they might very well be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, you know, that's part of the question that this study was looking at and that we're looking at in the VA as well, because people might be aware there's a problem, but most people coming back from a war, and I know this from talking to veterans years after, will say to themselves, well, I can shake this. I can handle it. Better if I don't talk about it. Better if I don't even think about it. And so there's knowing and there's knowing. One thing we want to encourage is if you think there might be a problem, it would be good to ask about it, although there are reasons why in the military, even in veteran status, a lot of people have second thoughts about bringing that up.
Now, as we've noted, PTSD isn't something that necessarily shows up immediately, right? I mean, a soldier could experience it immediately after coming back or years after.
Right.
So Jerry's on the phone with us from Raleigh. Now, he served in Vietnam from 1969 to 70. He's with the 25th Infantry Division near the Cambodian border. Jerry, thanks for speaking with us today.
Hello.
So, now, you weren't diagnosed until 1990, 20 years after you returned from the war, right?
That's right.
So, until that point, what was life like for you? Until the point, you know, these symptoms came up, was life fairly normal?
Well, I thought it was. It takes a lot of reflection later to realize that it wasn't. But, you know, I was successful in business. Everything was going fine. And in order to sleep at night, you know, I'd get drunk so I could sleep and so forth. But I just thought that was normal.
I see Harold Cudler, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, it's such a common story what Jerry's saying, that, you know, drinking gets to be the way these people have some kind of handle on how they're feeling. And unfortunately, it takes on a life of its own.
Right. So Jerry, what happened? When did things suddenly change, and what happened to change?
Well, eventually, I knew something. I knew it wasn't right. I mean, I had been living in circumstances where everything, when I went to bed at night, I had my shoes right there beside the bed. I had to lock the door all the way, lock the bedroom door. I had to have my glasses close to me, and I was having tremendous anxiety attacks. So I sought the help of a private psychiatrist.
And what did he tell you, or did you have any idea that this might be related to this condition?
Absolutely not. He told me on my second meeting, he says, you have post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's the first time that I had ever heard of that term.
Hmm. And what form has treatment taken, and has it helped?
Well, unfortunately at that time, he was a good psychiatrist, excellent psychiatrist, but most of my help has come from the Raleigh Vet Center. They are experts at this, and the VA hospital.
And have you met with other soldiers who've been experiencing the same things?
Yes, I go to, I have a one-on-one therapy at the Raleigh Vet Center, and we have group meetings down there where we meet once a week and we discuss our problems.
So just, you know, are you surprised what you're hearing about these new statistics, the new studies on soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan? Does it surprise you that they're coming home with symptoms that you experienced?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. It's I feel very sorry for them and their families, because these people are going to suffer. Luckily, this group of veterans has in place some help in the form of the vet centers throughout the country, so they do have a place to go, and I hope that they will go and get the help that they need.
Right. And another question, just, you know, we hear a lot about stigma, about soldiers unwilling to admit that they have a problem. You know, they might be suffering in silence. Does that make sense to you? Is that something, you know, you might have been reluctant to say?
Absolutely, because you have so much pride. You have so much pride in what you did and what you sacrificed and everything and you're in denial because you don't really think you have a problem. It's hard to admit that you have a problem, and especially if you're being successful in your job, it's hard to admit that you're having a problem.
Right. And at this point, has treatment been helping?
The treatment has been helping. It's the Raleigh Vet Center is a group of very intelligent, very compassionate people, and the program they have set up has been helping tremendously.
Jerry, thanks so much for spending time talking with us today.
Thank you.
And good luck. That's Jerry, who's a Vietnam veteran. He spoke to us from Raleigh. Harold Cudler? Sound like a typical story?
It really does. And this idea, a lot of people think, well, everybody who's got PTSD, they're looking for help, they're looking for a handout. In fact, in this large study that that Congress commissioned back in the 80s, when we looked at who did have PTSD, and the way they got the subjects was to use military records and just write to people who were, you know, at their homes, not people who were coming to the VA asking for help. More than half the people in that study who had PTSD had never gone to a VA for anything. not for help and not for compensation. And this gets back to Jerry's point. It was years after the war that he came forward and he was surprised to hear he had a problem. He had been through a lot and his body had been through a lot too, lack of sleep, alcohol and its effects. And this is exactly the pattern that we see. And I'm very glad to have a chance to talk on the show today because we want to get out to people and say, if you think you're having a problem, it would be good to talk and ask about it. But realizing that stigma makes it hard.
I want to talk more about the stigma. And also, but you talked about talking with Congress and hearings. I want to hear how the military and government is responding to some of these findings. Linda from Southern Pines has been waiting patiently on the line, and she has a comment. Linda, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to say that my son has a good friend who just got back from Iraq. He was a very sweet boy all through high school. But he got back from Iraq, and he wanted to reenlist right away because he says he wants to go back. He can't wait to kill more Iraqis. And I'm thinking, we're sending these boys over there to free these people, and they're coming back with this kill thing. And what are we doing to our boys? I mean, obviously, they're not being trained properly because it's not the Iraqis that they're supposed to be killing. So what is this going to do to these boys?
Well, thanks, Linda. Harold Cutler, I mean, here's someone who comes back and wants to go back and is maybe responding with an aggressive reaction to the experiences of war. Can that be a form of PTSD or, you know?
Well, without pretending to really, you know about this individual,
right.
When people come back from a war and they talk about going back, and many people do go back, sometimes it's because they no longer feel they fit at home. And, you know, they could cover it up with a lot of things like, I really want to go back and kill people. But when in fact what they're saying is, I don't fit in the way I used to. I don't know if I could fit in again. I don't know how people will feel about me either after what I've been through. So I'll go back to where at least my life made sense and I knew who I was for a while. It's also a very intense time of life. And for a lot of people, this is the most intense and a defining moment for them, which, by the way, might not just hurt them. Some people get stronger and develop a new life course from being in a war that is a better life course. We don't want to say war only destroys people. It makes other people stronger. And for most people, it's a mixture of trouble and growth. But back to this point. I think a lot of people don't know how to cope with their feelings after they've been through a war. I also want to mention a lot of people feel, most people who've been in a war feel intense loyalty to their buddies, to their troops, to their mission. And for that reason, we'll go back. Although I couldn't explain why this person might put it in terms of wanting to kill. That's certainly not a majority reaction.
I was just reading a New York Times Magazine article about two soldiers back, and they were very comfortable in each other's company, not comfortable with their families.
Well, that's why the vet centers were created. We should say where Jerry spoke about the vet centers, I agree with him entirely. After Vietnam, a lot of Vietnam veterans wouldn't go to VA hospitals. They just felt like that was an extension of a government that they weren't ready to deal with again. So the VA did something which a lot of people would never give credit for. They actually went out of their way to create storefront operations. They hired Vietnam veterans to run these operations, but they were veterans with counseling degrees, and they gave them training. And then they said, you go out, open up these storefronts, we'll fund you. There are now 206 of these across the country. It's veterans helping veterans. It's doctors, for the most part, aren't there, although they can refer back to the VA hospitals and get treatment and share it. We've got a number of these, one in Raleigh, one in Fayetteville, one in Greenville, Greensboro, of course, that's it. And these programs go on. And over the years, they've expanded from treating Vietnam veterans, which originally that was all they treated, to treating veterans of any combat era, including new combat veterans.
Now, the VA is catching these guys and women, soldiers, coming home. What about before deployment, and what about on the ground, in the field, in the theater? Is the military doing anything to nip this in the bud?
I just got back Tuesday from attending the Army's Force Health Protection meeting, which is their preventative medicine meeting. And there are a lot of people from Iraq and Afghanistan, a lot of high brass and people involved in training. Yes, the military is trying to build training in advance that will help people and also help with post-deployment questions. When people come back, they ask them about these things. Now, that doesn't mean people will give them honest answers. There are a lot of reasons why people don't always say, yes, I'm having a problem. For one thing, when you're coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, you just landed, and they say, would you like to tell us you have a psychiatric problem, and then we'll spend more time with you instead of going to home and see your family, most people will say, I know the right answer to this this test, and say, I haven't got a problem, but they may anyway. The military is trying. They've even got combat stress control programs overseas in combat zones, in areas of danger. They've got psychologists and military psychological help working with people right there to keep them near the front and working and in good health. So they're doing a lot.
Now, I've read that studies have actually shown it's better not to remove, say, stress-related combat veterans in the theater from the combat zone immediately.
It's been found that if you take people and say, oh, you poor guy, you're having a terrible problem, we better send you home, that those people tend to do less well at a one-year follow-up than people who are treated near the front, kept in uniform, still given duties to do, but also given sleep, rest, reassurance. Don't tell these people they're sick because they're not sick. They're soldiers. They're under a lot of stress. They need a little rest and recovery, but they need to know they're not being taken out of the game because they feel they need to stay to support the others. So you treat them near the front and you put them back in the front as soon as possible. This seems to provide the best outcomes.
We have just about a minute left. I'm really interested. How is the debate or the discussion about post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental disorders related to combat playing out in the political realm? I mean, are politicians, lawmakers talking about this and using it either for political expediency or to actually improve how the military deals with this issue?
Well, you know, clearly anything with politics can get confusing. But I've certainly met a lot of very dedicated politicians and staffers, congressional staffers, in the course of working on this. And I got to testify to Congress twice this last year. I'd say there's a great deal of dedication, and Congress is trying to come up with legislation that'll back this stuff. And the VA is trying to do it too, but money is tight.
And do you think the military is on top of this issue, though? Have things improved since post-traumatic stress disorder became a major topic of discussion?
There are leaders in the military who are pushing hard for this, and there are people who are less interested. But I think the people who are pushing are going to win in the end.
Great. Our thanks to Dr. Harold Cudler. Harold Cudler is Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Duke University and Coordinator for Mental Health for VA Network No. 6. Just ahead, drag queens and hissing cockroaches. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. Marriage, parenting, golf, and leather bars are just some of the topics that will be looked at in this year's North Carolina Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. The event takes place this weekend at the Carolina Theater in Durham. Jim Carl is senior director of the Carolina Theater. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Rusty.
Now, you were not at the theater when the first unofficial gay and lesbian film festival took place 10 years ago, but you know what the event was like. What kind of reception did that festival receive in Durham?
Well, about 10 years ago in 1995, the North Carolina Pride Committee, I believe, did come to the theater. The theater had just reopened, and they asked us if we would be willing to host a couple of films for them in conjunction with Pride that was happening here in Durham. The theater said yes, and long before you know it, there was all kinds of brouhaha happening over what the selection of the titles was going to be, over whether or not the theater should be hosting this type of a festival. But thankfully, that was only that first year. Since then, the festival has tremendously succeeded and is now one of the largest gay and lesbian film festivals in the country.
How does this festival now compare to other events at the Carolina Theater?
This is probably the largest event that the Carolina Theater now produces as far as an event that we host ourselves and that we produce ourselves. This particular festival draws about 10,000 attendees, and it has for the last 10 years.
And are you drawing a lot of submissions from filmmakers?
Oh, tremendous. The amount of submissions has just quadrupled over the last couple of years. I remember serving on that first programming committee, and we might have received 20 to 30 submissions. And from those 20 or 30 different films, finalizing a program that had perhaps 10 movies playing. And I mean, just this year, we received over 330 submissions. From that, we selected a final 94 titles that will play during the next 4 days.
Why are so many people coming to a gay and lesbian film festival in North Carolina now?
Well, it's the face of the festival has changed quite a bit. Of course, the landscape just on the mainstream conscious level across the United States has also changed tremendously in the last 10 years. Whereas 10 years ago, a gay and lesbian festival was attended primarily and intended to be attended primarily by gays and lesbians because there were so few positive gay and lesbian images in the media at that time. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, to be able to see a gay and lesbian image on television or in movies was usually depicted as a stereotype, depicted as a criminal, a pervert, or something like that. You really had to look hard to find positive images of gays and lesbians. Flash forward 10 or 15 years, and now practically every television show on TV and almost all the major motion pictures produced by Hollywood have a major character that's either a gay or a lesbian, or even things like Queer as Folk and Oz and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. There's so much more on television now available to audiences.
I don't want to put you in the position of being a spokesman for the gay and lesbian community, but I am curious if you see that, or if maybe the filmmakers you meet see that as a victory, that gay culture is so part of the mainstream.
It cuts both ways, though. It is a victory because the depictions of what's happening on screen on the films that we play here at the festival have changed tremendously, whereas 10 or 15 years ago, most of the stories that were being told were the coming-out stories or the AIDS dramas. Nowadays, people are experimenting with horror. You know, this is the first year that we had so many films that are just straight across the board horror films, not intended to be campy, but they just happen to have gays and lesbians, or sci-fi films, adventure films. You know, this is the first year we have Debs, which is our opening night film. That is a big budget spy movie with many of the characters that happens to be lesbian. Who would have thought that 10 years ago that would have a $30 million budget?
I'm curious, you know, if we're talking about gay culture becoming more part of the mainstream, I think one question that begs to be asked is, will there someday no longer be a need for a gay and lesbian film festival?
I hope not. I hope not. No, I think there'll always be a need for the festival. The festival serves a purpose more so than just having a showcase for movies, because remember, I'd say of the 94 films that we're playing at this year's festival, I'd say easily 70% of those, 70-80% of those films will probably never make it into theaters across the country. They're not going to be showing on television. They're not going to be available at your local video store. There will always be a need for a festival because there's too many movies being made by gays and lesbians that will probably never be picked up for distribution. And these filmmakers need a space to show their movies.
What are some of the highlights of this year's festival?
Well, the opening night film is Debs. On Friday night, we're really proud to have a film called Tying the Knot, which is a documentary that explores the gay marriage issue. On Saturday, we have Make-A-Wish, which is our centerpiece film for women. And that particular film is a straight-out horror film, much like Friday the 13th, just with an all-female cast. And then on Saturday night, the men's centerpiece film is called Eating Out, which is a big comedy. It's a big high-concept comedy. We also have four world premieres of films called Last Ride, Surge of Power, Nine Lives, and Collision.
We'd like to play a clip from one of the short films being shown this year.
Sure.
This is from a documentary called The Joy of Being Married.
So Thursdays was dubbed as their trailer park night. Some kind of white trash, you know, just cheap sounding names. And we thought Mary Kay, we thought Kmart, you know, K-A-Y Mart. And then it just sounded better with Mary Kay Mart. So Mary Kay Mart was born.
The filmmaker is Adam Atarian. He's a student at NC State University, and he studies documentary at Duke University. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
So tell us, who is Mary?
Mary Kay Mart is a drag queen based in Raleigh who I think has made quite a name for herself in hosting drag bingo every now and then. And then she also does a drag show every other Thursday night in a downtown Raleigh nightclub.
How did you meet Mary, and why were you interested in Mary?
Well, I think the first time I ever came in contact with Mary, I guess would be the best way to put it, was at an NC Pride Fest a couple years ago. I think she was driving a lawnmower down Main Street in Durham as part of the parade. And me and a couple friends just kind of went up to all the drag queens, are all standing together, and just kind of talked to them and see what they were doing.
And what did you want to show people? What did you want the viewers of your film to find out about or to learn about Mary?
Well, I think people, when they think of drag queens, have a lot of different notions come to mind. And I can't think of anyone that I've talked to whose notions have been remotely correct in terms of how drag queens exist in reality. So I really wanted to show with my film kind of what goes on literally behind the curtain and what the process is and like how someone can go from a hotel manager by day to an immensely popular drag queen by night.
Takes a great deal of dedication, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. I mean, I guess that's one of the big things I got out of producing it, was learning that it's just a lot of work for him to do what he does. Like, it takes a while to put on the makeup, to do the clothes, to get into character, to work out the entire act. It's not just like some small thing that, you know, they just throw on and run downtown.
And what do you think the reward is for all that work?
Well, I think they get to be someone who they may not necessarily be able to be in their everyday lives.
Now, this isn't your first film in the festival. What was your last film?
No, my first film was 2 years ago, and it was called The Kids Are All Right. And that was about looking at the lives of gay and lesbian teenagers in Wake County Public Schools in high school.
And let me just ask you quickly, I asked Jim Carl about the state of the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival and the role it serves. Again, you know, gay culture is maybe a more part of the mainstream. What about you? Why do you hope a Gay and Lesbian Film Festival continues to be around?
Well, you know, I think it comes down to just basically having film festivals based on genres, just like Full Frame Festival is for documentary, Gay and Lesbian Film Festival is for gay and lesbian films. I think that, you know, we'll always have different film festivals to meet different genres just because, you know, that's what film festivals are there for. Like, there's the Nevermore Film Festival, which concentrates on dark films. I don't think as time goes on, you know, it'll just be one huge film festival. I mean, that's what Blockbuster's for, I guess.
Well, Jim Carl is senior director of the Carolina Theater, and Adam Materian is director and producer of The Joy of Being Mary. The 9th annual North Carolina Gay and Lesbian Film Festival takes place this weekend at the Carolina Theater in Durham. Also this weekend, an annual celebration of bugs will take place at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. This is the museum's 8th annual Bug Fest, an opportunity for visitors to touch millipedes, learn about the difference between periodical and dog day cicadas, and find out about the feasibility of keeping an invertebrate as a pet. Daniel Johnson is an exotic animal veterinarian who will have an exhibit at Bug Fest this weekend. Hi, Dr. Johnson.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine. So, just what is the premier veterinary institution for bug vets?
I don't know if there is one premier veterinary institution. However, here in Raleigh, our practice, which is 100% exotic, in veterinary terms, that means that you are treating animals other than dogs and cats that people keep as pets. And we have now more recently had some bugs that people keep as pets come in as patients.
Now, I know some people keep tarantulas as pets, but what other kinds of bugs do you see people bringing in your practice?
Sure. Tarantulas are number one, but people also keep scorpions, praying mantises. To speak in larger terms of invertebrates, people also keep snails, and in their saltwater aquariums and what have you, there are other invertebrates that they keep.
How do you take a snail's temperature?
It's going to assume room temperature, so that's easy.
What do you think the allure is of these exotic pets, namely the invertebrate and the kinds that someone like I would call bugs?
Yeah, well, the appeal is that they are, number one, mostly inexpensive, mostly inexpensive. They are, relatively speaking, easy to keep, and especially when you consider that you don't have to take them out for walks, you don't have to buy heartworm preventative. In many cases, they're not getting the annual or routine veterinary care, which is something we hope to change, but routine veterinary care is often either not considered or overlooked, and so for that reason, they're popular as pets.
What kind of sicknesses and injuries are you treating most commonly? I mean, you know, when has someone brought in a pet snail?
That's a publication that's currently out there. I think it's NC State University fixed a fracture on an apple snail. They performed a shell repair much as would be done on a box turtle. And with time, the mantle, the shell-producing tissue underneath, produced a repair. And the patch was able to be removed, and the apple snail went on to be happy. So that's where we're learning about stuff like this and where... right now, I would say the most common things we see are husbandry, environment, bug fest, and traditional insect education focuses on how important insects are to the environment. And the problems I see as a veterinarian are the reverse. They're the problems of the environment or inappropriate environment on the insect. And so if a tarantula is kept too dry, for example, it has difficulty shedding when it's time to grow, which they shed periodically. The same is true in terms of the diet. You might offer an inappropriate diet for an insect or snail or otherwise. And problems develop over time. So for most of the animals I treat, in fact, birds, snakes, ferrets, rabbits even, most of the problems we treat are husbandry-related, things that are considered well taken care of and already covered and just usual and customary for somebody to know about their cat, how to take care of it. Those are problems, those are the most common problems where people make mistakes with exotic pets.
Now, just to be clear, what is husbandry?
Husbandry means how you take care of something. So it's basically diet, environment, heat, humidity, cage substrate, lighting. Various reptiles and other birds, for example, need specific lighting to provide the UV light that activates vitamin D, gives them healthy bones and calcium levels. Those are broadly categorized as husbandry, so anything that has to do with how you take care of, feed, and house.
Now, I have to ask you this. I don't know if you're the one to answer it, but I need to know, what role do roaches play in our world, in our ecosystem? There must be a role, but I can't figure out what it is other than to terrify me when I find one sitting on the wall ready to fly.
Yeah, well, actually, our booth at Bugfest will be the hissing booth, we call it. We have the Madagascar hissing cockroaches at our booth, and folks love to come around, and when you pick these things up, they get angry or uncomfortable, and they hiss. And that's kind of a scary thing. But these cockroaches, Madagascar hissing cockroaches, are roughly 2 to 3 inches long and maybe an inch across. But they're very clean, you understand. They eat fruit. They don't live under your bathroom sink. In the wild, I think cockroaches play a role as sort of a detritus feeder. They take small garbage and make it even smaller. And,
And what about the ones under the sink?
Under the sink? They're there just to terrorize us.